Good afternoon, Council. The last case on our argument calendar for the en banc court this afternoon is in the matter of the guardianship of the person in the state of Ida Rubin, case number 80300. Mr. Freer, Mr. Wall, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. We have myself, Justice Perry Gary, and Justice Kadish in Carson City, and Justice Pickering, Justice Silver, and Justice Herndon on the bench in Las Vegas. Justice Stiglitz is participating. You may not be able to see her face, but she is on the video. Just we're not able to maintain the feed that shows her her face, so she may have questions in this matter, of course. All right, Mr. Freer, if you would proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Alan Freer representing the appellants Jason and Maya Rubin. I would like to reserve 2 minutes to respond. We're here today to request the court's construction of the guardianship statutes and provide guidance concerning standards and procedure in contested guardianship proceedings. The underlying matter in this case arose when Jason, who's Ida's son, was contacted by Ida's community association expressing concerns it had with Ida's well-being and relaying a series of recent events of repeated delusions. With these records, Jason filed his first petition with the guardianship court requesting that Ida be evaluated to determine if guardianship is appropriate and requesting temporary and general guardianship. After receiving an objection by Ida, the district court denied the first petition without prejudice due to a lack of a physician certificate and instructing Jason that he could refile when one was obtained. Thereafter, Jason followed the court's instructions and filed a second petition that included all the information and evidence he had available to him, including the additional Metro records, which detailed 35 incidents reports of similar delusions, and a physician certificate and report from Dr. Gregory Brown, a psychiatrist with forensic certification and 24 years of experience in civil commitment evaluations. Dr. Brown reviewed the Metro and Association records and opined that they illustrated generalized concerns of psychosis. His attached report further stated the delusions were reported highly, quote, highly congruent with schizophrenia, close quote, placing Ida at an elevated risk of harm from erratic behavior and noting that the increasing frequency of events suggested a worsening mental condition that was not improving on its own. Dr. Brown recommended a temporary guardianship of the person for a short period to permit a full psychiatric and a neurological evaluation, but stated he could not opine about the need for guardianship because he does not have access to Ida. Based on the additional evidence in the report, the second petition again requested Ida's evaluation and a temporary and general guardianship. In response to the objections filed by Ida and her son Mark, the district court denied Jason's second petition and his second discovery requests and entered an order denying on the grounds that the physician certificate was insufficient. From this, Jason asserts three grounds of error from the second order. Specifically, the district court erred in finding and ordering the physician certificate required personal evaluation. Second, the district court erred by refusing to open discovery and or permit an evidentiary hearing. And third, the district court and erred by summarily finding that a guardianship may not be necessary due to the existence of a power of attorney. As to the first assignment of error, the district court erred in requiring that a physician certificate contain a personal evaluation of Ida where Jason had no access to it. A plain reading of the physician certificate requirement, NRS 159-044 subsection 2I, reveals there is no requirement for an in-person examination. Indeed, had the legislature wanted to require an in-person evaluation, it could have included language similar to the involuntary commitment statutes 433A-200, which do require in-person evaluation. Further, even if an in-person evaluation could be implied, a plain reading of subsection 2 and the application of the scope of subparts canon of construction demonstrates the physician certificate requirement is necessarily limited by the extent to which Jason is able to reasonably ascertain or obtain such information. Specifically, subsection 2 starts with an overarching clause stating, quote, to the extent petitioner knows or reasonably may ascertain or obtain the information set forth in the subparts, he is required to provide the same. In other words, the requirement of the physician certificate is limited to Jason's best efforts to provide that required information. He did so by providing a certificate and report from a forensic psychiatrist who analyzed available records and opined on what he had reviewed. So accordingly, we assert the district court erred by summarily dismissing the petition through its imposed requirement of an in-person examination where Jason had no access to items. The second assignment of error is the district court's refusal to grant discovery or an evidentiary hearing despite repeated requests. The argument that incapacity must first be proven by clear and convincing evidence prior to allowing discovery disregards the statutory and procedural structure of Chapter 159. If such were the case, Section 044, Subsection 2 would not contemplate or excuse situations where the petitioner lacked the required information. Similarly, if there's no access to the proposed protected person or medical records, then it would be impossible for a petitioner to prepare a physician's assessment plan under 159.044 subsection 3 or a proposed care plan under 159.0445. Rather, the opportunity for discovery and taking evidence is contemplated by the guardianship statutes. For example, the district court is to make determinations of incapacity and is to apply a clear and convincing evidentiary standard to determine if guardianship is required. These determinations cannot be made without a procedure for obtaining and presenting evidence. The Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure not only afford such procedure, but are also intended to apply in guardianship proceedings. The advisory committee notes to the Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 3, state that, quote, a complaint includes a petition, close quote, such as a guardianship petition. Further, Chapter 159 references to the Rules of Civil Procedure in at least four separate statutes, including Sections 23, 34, 475, and 525. As such, the Rules of Civil Procedure are intended to apply to Chapter 159. Now further, the Rules of Civil Procedure permit discovery for mental health examinations under Rule 35A1. The other areas in Title 13 in which 159 is located use the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure to determine similar competency and capacity issues, such as a trust proceeding under 164.015, and a power of attorney proceeding under 162A330. For these and other civil proceedings involving capacity and competency, the privacy concern of those individuals is just as important, and yet the Rules of Civil Procedure's proportionality limitations and motions for protective order are found to afford sufficient protections. Moreover, if the district court had a particular concern about engaging in a discovery process, it has additional statutory tools under 159 to obtain the required information. For example, the court can appoint a guardian ad litem to investigate and provide any information required by the court under Section 455. Moreover, the district court can even appoint a physician or other investigators to evaluate capacity and other issues and report to the court under Section 456. So given the availability of these statutes and rules for providing discovery and presenting evidence, the district court's summary rejection for requested discovery and an opportunity to present evidence is likewise error.
Mr. Traynor?
Yes.
Sorry, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City, so you can find the right square on your screen, hopefully there. So here's my question. We have this statute 159.044, which talks about the requirements for the petition. And I understand, you know, some of the concerns you've raised as a practical matter. But even if the physician didn't have to have an in-person exam, I understand it doesn't specifically say that. It does say that the certificate has to state the need for a guardian and whether the proposed protected person presents a danger to himself or others, right? There are other requirements as well. And
that is
so,
correct.
So in this case, the doctor was unable to certify the need for a guardian, at least at this point, with what was submitted, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And
well, actually, Your Honor, he basically said that there is a worsening condition and that he was concerned that there was danger to herself based on her actions acting out on the delusion. So it's right. In the report, if you look at section 295, he details a substantial risk of physical harm. It's not a checked box on page 292 of the appendix. But if you go down into the report section attached to that, mm-hmm. he details a substantial risk of harm that, and Ida had already had delusions that had made her act out and respond to other individuals.
Okay. So in terms of your, I saw the doctor, I guess, opined about possible harm or possible risk of harm because she's verbally attacking individuals she doesn't know based upon her delusions, and that could place her at risk. And so if I understand it, the risk is that this apparently 80-year-old woman going out on the golf course and yelling at people that they're the LAPD or something somehow is going to possibly cause those people to harm her? Is that what the risk is that would justify a guardianship?
That is a part of the risk. The other parts that were concerning to Dr. Brown and listed in his report is that the incidents were increasing with frequency.
Yeah.
And she had also provided reports that she had been burned and bruised or beaten by these alleged LAPD assailants. And so you have indicia of potential harm to herself and to others, at least based on these reports.
Right.
And we would proffer...
Sorry, I was just going to say, assuming she is suffering from some form of mental illness, let's just assume for a moment that's true, whether it's a psychosis or dementia or something. Let's assume that there's something like that. She still wouldn't be subject to a guardianship unless there was a risk of harm to herself or others, right?
Absolutely. And our position is that the requirements under NRS 159.044 subsection 2 are essentially pleading requirements. Those are to get you kind of in the door for the to kind of establish what information you've got and what information is available, and then to allow proceeding where the court can ultimately make the determination whether the guardianship is required.
Okay. Is there any indication she actually hurt anybody or that anybody hurt her?
No, not during the period. There, after the guardianship, and we put this in our reply brief, there was a legal hold placed on her, but there wasn't any incidents during the proceeding as to alter actions or self-harm.
Mr. Freer, this is Justice Stiglitz. So if we credit the position that the physician, that the court erred by finding the physician had to personally inspect her at this point in time, if we credit that position, what do we do with the rest of the court's findings that also credit that there's a concern for her well-being and safety, but observes that there may still not be necessary to have a guardianship because there's less restrictive means? She had already chosen a guardian of her choice in the event a guardianship became necessary, directing him to monitor her. So I, what do we do with those findings of the court that credit there may be a problem, but say, hey, that doesn't mean I'm going to step in and appoint a guardian that she didn't plan for?
Right. So first, the existence of the power of attorney was disputed, and its effectiveness was a disputed issue of fact. But the other issue you raise does get into the third point of error, and our last assignment of error is finding that a guardianship may not, was the finding of the courts that the guardianship may not be necessary for the power of attorney. So while 159 references the powers of attorney, there isn't any interaction with respect to how it interplays with Section 54, subsection 3, which it speaks in terms of the general guardianship. What we would assert is that there needs to be a three-part analysis under this 54 before you rely on the power of attorney. First, is the proposed protected person incapacitated such that a guardianship would be warranted? Second, is there a less restrictive means available, such as a power of attorney, to operate instead of the guardianship? And third, if so, is it in the best interest of the proposed protected person to operate under the power of attorney? Or in other words, is the power of attorney going to appropriately do the job? Here, because Jason asserted concerns about the power of attorney and Mark's failure to act under that, having the court just summarily defer to that without any analysis is our ground for error.
Mr. Freer, I think we're out of time unless another justice has a question. I just wanted to confirm that the record in this case did not provide any basis for a guardianship of the estate of Ms. Rubin, did it?
No, not at the initial stage. We're essentially kind of at a pleading stage, as we set forth in our briefing.
All right. So let's ask Mr. Wall to proceed. We had a couple of questions. I'll give you a couple of additional minutes, Mr. Freer, to respond, and Mr. Wall, you'll have 2 minutes added to your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Hardesty and Associate Justices, I am, may it please the court, I am pleased to be here today and privileged to represent Ida Rubin. I have spent some time with her, and she is a person who is caring for herself for 30 years. All of the evidence that is in the record demonstrates that she has the ability to care for herself. Her yard is immaculate. Her house is immaculate. She takes care of all of her own bills. Her fridge is full of food. All of the same records that Jason wants to rely upon to demonstrate in his view that he should have an open fishing license to go for her personal and private information against her will is demonstrates that she does not need a guardian. The main thing that I think that the record demonstrates, which counsel and which Jason and has ignored, is that the district court did not deny a guardianship simply because the district court didn't like the fact that the first time around there was no medical certificate, physician certificate, or that the second time around she thought that the physician certificate wasn't didn't satisfy the statute to be a physician certificate. She looked at everything that was presented to her, and it's clear from the record, and she determined that not enough had been shown. Counsel continues to refer to this matter as we're in the pleading stage, but this is not a complaint. It is a petition. And a petition, although it qualifies to be covered by the rules of civil procedure, is not a complaint. And it does not follow the same exact procedures. Just as this court considers petitions and acts as a gatekeeper to determine what will be allowed and what won't be allowed. In a petition for guardianship, the district court is a gatekeeper. We are not here today to determine what rights to discovery Jason has. Jason doesn't have rights here. The protected person here is Ida Rubin, and we are here to determine what rights she has, and at what point, when a petition is filed, a petitioner who in this case is an adversary to Ida. In this case is a person who Ida not only fears, but has good reason to fear. A person who Ida would never allow to have access to her medical records, to her financial records. That would be her. She has in place documents, a plan, and that plan requires that her brother and her son Mark make determinations on her behalf. And even though the statute requires that Mark and her brother should have been given a citation with respect to this matter, that wasn't done. Jason is concerned about his own recovery from his mother. He wants an inheritance. And Jason didn't talk to the brother who is available. Jason didn't talk to Mark. The representation that is continually made that Mark has failed to act is not supported by anything in this record. The only thing that supports that is Jason saying, I think Mom needs a guardian, and Mark hasn't sought to have a guardian appointed, so he has failed to act. The failure to act for Mark is there, he helps her out, he visits her, he is completely capable. There has never been anything in this record which would suggest that Mark has not been there, that the brother is not available, that Ida cannot care for herself. And so we come to what is the district court's job? The standard that we're talking about here is abuse of discretion. The statutes are very broad and very non-specific in many ways as to what a district court can do, because it leaves that authority to the district court to exercise the discretion that court has. As counsel pointed out, the district court can appoint a guardian ad litem. The district court can appoint investigators. The district court can hold a hearing and direct the parameters of that hearing. What it doesn't say in any of these statutes is that the district court may allow discovery. I'm not suggesting that no discovery would ever be allowed. What I am suggesting is that the petitioner has a burden to carry. And while the statutes aren't exactly clear as to exactly how and when that burden is to be carried, under NRS 159.055, the petitioner has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the appointment of a guardian of the person or the estate is necessary. That's the petitioner's burden, because he's going to interfere with the rights and liberties of the target. And the statute goes on to say, if it appears to the district court that the allegations of the petition are sufficient and that a guardian should be appointed, the court shall enter an order appointing a guardian. The district court has to exercise authority to decide what will be allowed and to whom.
This is Justice Kadish in Carson City. I hope we find the right box. Want to ask you then, right? So looking at it from the petitioner's perspective, there's all this documentation of numerous calls, apparently at an increasing frequency, to security and police and other people that she's calling in, and if she's approaching, you know, strangers on the golf course, you know, there, it seems like there might be some legitimate basis for concern. So what should be done?
There is certainly legitimate basis for concern, and Ida certainly is delusional at times. She has been suffering from these delusional things for 30 years, not just recently. I went through carefully in my brief and set forth exactly what those documents show. Ida went out onto the golf course and spoke to some people once. We have no idea what the circumstances were, and there is no reason in the world for Dr. Brown to jump to the conclusion from that Ida is in danger. She took herself that same week to her own doctor's appointment, which she scheduled herself. She has done all of these other things. She sometimes does have some very significant fears. Some of these fears date back to 1988 when she was investigated over a long period of time over Jason's criminal activity. And she is frightened to death of Jason because of that. What has to be done here...
Mr. Wall, if I could interrupt you for a moment, sir. This is Justice Herndon. I'm curious about your comment that she, and you alluded to this earlier, that she has some great fear of Jason. My understanding is Jason is the alternate healthcare agent under her power of attorney. Mark was first and Jason was second, which seems kind of odd if she has this great fear that you're referencing of him.
That was true, Your Honor, when she first did the paperwork, but long ago she took Jason out. Every aspect of her plan. At the time that Jason filed his petition, he was neither first nor second nor in there at all. He'd been completely excluded from
that. Mr. Wall, this is Justice Hardesty. If I could direct your attention to 159.044 subsection 2, and looking at that statute from the language of the statute, it says, to the extent the petitioner knows or reasonably may ascertain or obtain, the petition must include without limitation. And what Mr. Freer has argued and what was contended before the district court in connection with the motion for reconsideration, which was treated as a subsequent petition here, is that they had provided what they knew to the district court. I get the point that this is a matter of discretion for the district court to exercise. But it does seem like there has been a prima facie showing, at least, of facts that would cause some further examination and some alternatives to explore any risk to the proposed protected person. How did you address that issue in the district court?
That issue is addressed in a couple of ways. Number one, there matters are still ongoing in district court. There are still guardianship proceedings ongoing in district court, and there are proceedings ongoing with respect to the planning documents. I would disagree, Your Honor, respectfully, that there was a prima facie showing of anything if you look at this thing carefully. There was no showing of any danger, any that she can't care for herself now, that she's not, that there's a financial loss that it's threatened. Nothing, no prima facie case was shown. And that's why the district judge said, you haven't shown me enough. She even said, if you didn't have this medical record, if you had something else, she said, if you had piles of medical records, or if you had something to demonstrate to me that Ida is in need of a guardian, that, but you haven't got anything. And this is with respect to the statute. The response is that even though subsection 2 says, to the extent the petitioner knows or reasonably may ascertain, when you look at all of the different subsections, all of those have to do with non-evidentiary matters except one. The only one that has to do with evidentiary matters and demonstrating whether or not she is or the target is in need of a guardian is subsection I. And subsection I says, summary, you have to include, to the extent you have it, a summary of the reasons why a guardian is needed and recent documentation demonstrating the need. And then it continues with, the documentation must include without limitation. That section is not subject to subparagraph 2. If it was, there would be no reason for repeating that part, or you would put that language in there again. The things that must be there, the documentation must include, without limitation, that's what the legislature has designated. There has to be a certificate from a physician, or there has to be something from somebody, which is the equivalent of that certificate from the physician, and then there has to be evidence regarding the need for a guardian, whether the protected person presents a danger to him or herself, whether the protected person can comprehend the reason for the hearing, whether they're capable of living independently. Ida lives independently. Any examination of whether of this record to determine whether or not Ida is capable of living independently would demonstrate that she has done that. This is the evidentiary part. You have to have something in the petition that would warrant going beyond the petition itself and interfering with the rights of the target, especially when the person who's trying to interfere with the rights of the target isn't the person who has been selected by the protected person to be the person to be doing this.
And Mr. Mark Wall,
my understanding
is that Ida was present during the district court proceedings.
Yes, she was.
As required by statute.
Yes, she was.
Okay, I'm sorry, Justice Silver.
What if, like here, they're saying that, you know, hey, my brother has the power of attorney, but is failing miserably at protecting my mother. Why not give some kind of evidentiary hearing, limited discovery, to ensure that the person is protected?
I have no problem with giving some discovery or doing some investigation or having a guardian ad litem look into this or any of those things which the statute does not prohibit and clearly would allow if the circumstances warranted it. But first there has to be some kind of a basic showing of necessity to do that. And the main thing that they have turned this into is they wanted to do discovery, really, really invasive discovery, into Ida's life, and the district judge said, based on what I have in front of me, I'm not going to allow that. And they have turned this into the judge summarily decided this case, and the judge is never going to allow discovery, and there should have been discovery in this case. The parade of horribles in this case is that a person like Jason, with his history and with the history between the parties, and the fact that she has, from the time she moved into this, to Las Vegas, has not allowed him to visit or allowed him to be a part of her life, the person she believes and personally witnessed, who took advantage as a guardian of her aunt and stole her money and put her in a cage, this is the person who is asking the court for carte blanche to do whatever discovery wants to do, compelled on a showing as weak as the showing in these petitions. I can't imagine it. If there was a great showing, Your Honor.
Mr. Wall.
If there's really a need, something could be done, but this isn't that case.
Mr. Wall, just a quick follow-up. So Mark, who's her other son, who you've been talking about, did he have separate counsel in the district court, and does he have separate counsel now?
Yes, he did, and yes, he does. He joined our brief, however, on the appeal. But he did have separate counsel and did participate in the district court, and he specifically was there and available and made that clear.
Okay.
What they mean by he's not available or not doing something is, he's not doing what Jason wants him to do, and Jason wants control of Ida's estate because Jason wants his inheritance to come more quickly. And that's what this case has been about. The district court did not abuse her discretion when she looked at these petitions and found them wanting.
Mr. Freer?
Yes, I'd first respond that a lot of these factual allegations that are being raised are nothing more than allegations are not supported in the record because the court never got to that point.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Freer. That was presented to the district court that this Jason had abused the aunt previously. Is that correct? That was presented to the district court, and was that part as well of her reasoning here?
Well, so with respect to that, we provided evidence down below that was essentially rebutted and debunked because the allegations of abuse were coming from a disbarred attorney who himself was abusing the particular person that Sierra Ross was her name. So that concern was reported and addressed with the court down below and demonstrated to be false. But the court, district court, never really got into the issues of suitability or preference for guardian because it stopped at the stage of this physician certificate. Now, protecting the rights of a proposed person is a function of the court that the court should take seriously, but the procedural mechanisms for such protections should not be applied so rigorously as to turn away a person in need of a guardianship simply because a petitioner doesn't have access to the person. So for that reason, we're requesting that the court espouse an appropriate procedure in contested guardianship proceedings, whether after the presentation of the initial petition, make a determination of what information the petitioner has been able to reasonably ascertain and in the initial petition, have the determination of what discovery is permitted and available, and an opportunity to present evidence to the district court in order for it to make a determination of guardianship at the end of the day under 150, under section 054, which includes an analysis of whether a power of attorney is available and appropriate to operate instead of the guardianship proceeding.
Is that it, Mr. Freer? Have you concluded?
My time is up. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Wall and Mr. Freer, both, for your excellent briefing and your arguments in this important case. Unless my colleagues have any questions, the matter will stand submitted. Seeing none, we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Thank you.